Ecclesiastes 3. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward, and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? This is the word of the Lord.
Please pray with me. Father, I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart will be acceptable to you, for you are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. When I mentioned to someone recently that I was going to preach a series on the book of Ecclesiastes, he responded by saying, you know, I've heard that that's probably the best book to give to a person who doesn't know the Lord as Savior. And I thought, isn't that interesting? And I asked, why is that so? And he said, well, because essentially the message of the book is that everything try in life and seek and pursue for fulfillment ends up leaving you unsatisfied. And consequently, it creates a sense that the things that this world offers to us are vaporous in nature, which is an interesting thing to think about because the term vapor, or the word vapor, is a word in the Hebrew that recurs throughout the course of the book of Ecclesiastes. It's translated in the English Standard Version and many other versions as it's translated into English as vanity. So wherever you see the word vain or vanity in the book of Ecclesiastes, the actual Hebrew word is referring to vapor. The idea being that just as James says in his book in the New Testament, our lives are vaporous. They appear like a mist on the horizon for a period of time, and then the adversity of life, and the sun rises and burns it all away. Everything is temporary, transient in nature. Wisdom should help us see this without the help of divine revelation. All you need to do is just think a bit about life. Just this week, in fact, it was just yesterday, I was in a coffee shop, had an opportunity to talk to a young man, and just over the course of the conversation, I mentioned Charlton Heston. I thought, everyone knows who Charlton Heston is. And he looked at me with this vacuous expression, this vacant expression. I said, you know, Charlton Heston, you know, like from the Ten Commandments and Soylent Green and all those great films. And no. So, well, there's an illustration in two respects. There was an illustration that didn't work that time and I hope works now. There's a guy who won Academy Awards and was the biggest actor you could imagine in his day, and young people today have no clue who he is. In fact, some of you may have no clue who he is. That's okay. You don't need to go find him. I'm just trying to make a point. People that you think are really important today, that you think, oh, I just got to be like that guy, someday will be forgotten. Vapor. Now, we're aware of this, and because it's an unpleasant thing to think about, we try to divert ourselves and distract ourselves from this harsh truth. Here's something I came across from Blaise Pascal on the very subject of diversions. And he says this from his famous book of thoughts, Pensée. The only thing that consoles us for our miseries is diversion. And yet, it is the greatest of our miseries, for it is that, above all, which prevents us thinking about ourselves and leads us imperceptibly to destruction. But for that, we should be bored, and boredom would drive us to seek some more solid means of escape. But diversion passes our time and brings us imperceptibly to our deaths. He wrote that in the 18th century, and they didn't even have smartphones then. So this is not like a new problem. We have been working hard forever at diverting ourselves from unpleasant truths. We just have means at our disposal today that people in the past didn't have. Now, one of the things that happens in our society is people make a lot of money off of this need to divert our attention or our desire to have our attentions diverted from this terrible fact. And the economy is driven by this. Amusement parks are created to help with that. You get what I'm getting at. There are lots of ways in which we're encouraged to pursue vaporous things in hope that they'll satisfy us. And we pursue these things knowing sort of in the back of our minds, this isn't going to work out the way I hope it will. You've probably had the experience of being very excited about a purchase that you've made. And then having to clean out the basement years later saying, I can't believe I was so excited about this junk I have now to throw into the garbage can. We're doing that at our house right now. The basement filled with high-tech gadgets that I remember opening with great enthusiasm and excitement, and now they're just junk. But isn't it amazing that we just keep at it, that we just never seem to learn, that we just sort of, again, divert ourselves thinking that this next time, this new next purchase, this next experience, that's going to be the thing that does it. Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, said, "Foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds." Let me tell you what, we all are guilty of foolish consistency. We all have little hobgoblins working in our minds, telling us this time will be different, and it's not. It's the same old thing over and over again. Wisdom knows there's a time for everything, and that's a marvelous truth that we see here laid out for us in this third chapter. There's a time for this and a time for that. Time to be born, a time to die. And everything is beautiful in its time. That's the promise. We see that in verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. There's a timeliness that he's referring to. He's not just thinking about sort of time as we normally think of it, as a procession of moments, succession of minutes and seconds and hours and days and so forth. But there's a timeliness, what in Greek is referred to as kairos, a kind of kairos moment. You know, Greek is a marvelous language because it does so much in terms of making distinctions between different kinds of things. There are just a number of, there are like six words for love in Greek. And there are a couple of words for time in Greek. One is chronos, where we get the word chronology. That just means a succession of moments. But the other is what's being referred to here, kairos. There's a timeliness. There's a right time. And there's a time, hopefully, when in our lives we come to see that the things that we can acquire in this life won't satisfy. And that would be a beautiful thing if and when a person experiences that sense of this is not going to satisfy, because there's only one thing it can satisfy. And the reason why there's only one thing it can satisfy is found there in the second half of the 11th verse of that third chapter of Ecclesiastes. Says after he makes that statement, he has made everything beautiful in its time. He goes on to say, also, this is Solomon speaking now, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. But that phrase, he has put eternity into his heart. He's given us a longing for something that the things of this world will never satisfy. Augustine, in his great work, Confessions, at the very start, says famously, O Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. Sometimes it's put, more colloquially with the idea that, everyone has kind of a God-shaped vacuum or a God-shaped hole that can only be filled by God. Well, if you think about that at all, what you realize is that God is infinite and the whole is infinite. And the only thing that can fill the infinite whole is the infinite God. That's the implication. But there's points in our lives where we get a sense that there is a God and that God will satisfy. There's a kind of moment that can occur that the longing and the satisfaction are both intuited because God graciously reveals through the course of our lives that there's something more out there that he is able to do for us, and there's a satisfaction that we can have in him. There's a marvelous word. I like words. I'm not a super wordsmithy kind of person, but I do love the fact that there are words out there that express just, sort of rich and deep ideas. And sometimes they're in other languages. German is another one of those languages that's just tremendously precise and has a way of expressing thoughts that sometimes in English require a few sentences. But one of those words is Sehnsucht. And I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it right. If there's a German speaker here, forgive me. But that word is a word that expresses this very thing. The idea is that you can become aware through your longing that there is something beautiful that can satisfy that longing. That the longing itself is more satisfying than the things of this life that don't satisfy. Here's a quote from C.S. Lewis where he describes what this word means. He says, that unnameable something, desire for which pierces us like a rapier at the smell of a bonfire, the sound of wild ducks flying overhead, the title the well at the world's end, the opening lines of Kublai Khan, the morning cobwebs in late summer, or the noise of falling waves. There's something that occurs, and it may not have occurred for you with any of those things that have been described, but hopefully there has been something that has happened in your life that's given you some sense that there's something more, that it's not just an empty longing that can never be satisfied, but that there is something there. Just like everything else in your life for which you have a longing, you have a satisfaction. This longing has a satisfaction, and you get a sense of that. I hope that's been true for you. That's a beautiful thing. Now, wisdom seeks consolation, but in the process of seeking consolation, it evaluates what is proffered as providing that satisfaction. Evaluation, marvelous word, evaluate, determine the value of something. And here we see Solomon in verse 9 asks this rhetorical question. What gain has the worker from his toil? What gain has the worker from his toil? You probably think that same thought every time you get your paycheck. What gain has the worker from his or her toil? Now, we see here in chapter 4, Solomon go into this sense of futility and vanity when it comes to this very thing. It says in verse 4, "Then I saw," this is chapter 4, "then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor." He's getting at the keeping up with the Joneses thing. Comes from that. "This is also vanity, vaporous, and striving after wind." So there's this sense that often what drives us is the fear that somebody else is getting something instead of you or I, and that thing that they're getting is satisfying them. And if you can only have that same thing or have it in greater measure, you'll be satisfied too. Sort of foolishly reading into the behavior of the other person something that isn't even true for yourself. That's the sort of the sense of the vanity of your pursuit. On the other hand, you know, we're told that Solomon tells us that the other extreme is not very good either. We see in verse 6, he says, "Better is a handful of quietness." I'm sorry, verse 5. "The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh." So we're in this quandary. We have to work, yet work doesn't fully satisfy. We find ourselves in that awkward spot. Nevertheless, even so, we find no true satisfaction even when we keep at work, because when we come to the end of our lives and we've accumulated the goods of this life, we find that we have to leave them to somebody else and sometimes no one else. You see that referred to in verse 8. He says in verse 7, "Again I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are not satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?' This also is vaporous and an unhappy business." So the eye is never satisfied, but you can't just sort of quit the labors that have to be performed. So we find ourselves in this quandary. And it's more discouraging than even that, because what we see in chapter 3 and again in chapter 4 is that even when you work and labor, it's possible that the fruits of your labor are withheld from you because of theft or oppression or something of that nature that keeps you from enjoying the fruit of your labors. If you look at chapter 3, see there verse 16, the description of the situation I just described. "Moreover, I saw under the sun, that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. And if you jump over to chapter 4, verse 1, again I saw the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors was power, and there was no one to comfort them. So even though we labor and toil for things that don't satisfy, even the small measure of satisfaction that we can enjoy from those things, sometimes that is taken from us because of the wickedness of other people. There is a promise. Solomon doesn't leave us completely in despair at this point. If you look at verse 17 of chapter 3, he notes, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. For there, and then he goes back to what he notes earlier, there is a time for every matter and for every work. So God will set things right. But even so, here we are in a world in which we see the vapors all around us. We attempt to hold on to things, believing that they're solid, and the vapors just pass through our fingers. Everything seems to be passing away before us. And in a fit of despair at this point, you can almost see Solomon throwing up his hands in verses 18 to 21 of chapter 3. He goes on to say, I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. There's a happy thought. And what happens to the children of man is what happens to the beast, and that what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts. All is vaporous. And then he, in an even more cheerful fit, says in chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, it's better not even to live a life in light of all this. Verse 2, and I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. This is the sort of thing that will get you locked up in a mental institution and put on drugs. But here we have it. He's telling us the truth about the nature of the world in which we live and its vaporous character. I know what you're thinking. Pastor Chris, it's an overcast day. It's winter. I need some sunshine in my life. I need a little light. I need a little encouragement. I don't need this parade through the sort of the illusions that we all know are illusory. I need something solid to hold on to. There's a reason, though, that we need to do this. And we see it referred to in chapter 7, verse 4. This is a really good verse. If you're the sort of person who underlines verses in your Bible, I think this is one of the ones that you should underline. Verse 4 reads, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. It's when you know what you can lose or what can be lost. It's when you know that, that you know what you shouldn't invest yourself too much in, right? I think disillusionment, folks, is a good thing, because if you have an illusion, it should be dissed. You see what I'm getting at? We live in a world full of phantoms, these vaporous promises that surround us, that deceive us, that we buy into because we want to believe that they're true. But when they're taken from us, and this, by the way, is often the case when it comes to why people come around. You may have known people in your life. You may be able to think back in your own life to your own experience, to that moment when you realize that there is only one way. When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, there's only one way. And often it's that sense of devastation that you feel when the things that you believed in prove themselves to be vaporous. That is the turning point. It's the moment at which you say, all right, I'm ready for some reality, for a change. I need something that's solid. This, by the way, is some nice time to sort of bring another word to your attention that contrasts well with this word vapor. And that's the word glory. The word glory in Hebrew means heavy, like gold, solid. When the Shekinah glory of the Lord entered the temple at the dedication that Solomon, by the way, prayed for, that weight of glory sent everybody onto their bellies. So solid, so real. That's what you need. That's what I need. We need that kind of solidity in our lives. Now, there are consolations, and we should do justice to those consolations by noting them. One of those consolations is friends, companions. And we see here in chapter 4, verses 9 through 12, Solomon talking about this consolation that we can enjoy in life. This is why the fellowship of the church is so important. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cold is not quickly broken. There are consolations in life. There's also the consolation of the simple life, and we see that referred to in the sixth verse of the fourth chapter. And this ought to remind you of 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. Godliness with contentment is great gain. The simple things in life. You've heard that said, you know, the simple things in life are free. Well, they are and they're not. They're free in the sense that they're to be enjoyed by God's grace. But what they'll cost you is, you know, giving up that foolish pursuit of vaporous stuff. You can't enjoy the simple things in life while giving yourself over to illusions and pursuing things that won't satisfy. What all this is intended to do is something that I'm afraid Solomon couldn't help us with. You know, the Lord contrasted his own work with the wisdom of Solomon. He said, "One now greater than Solomon is among you," referring to himself. The Lord knew something that Solomon didn't know. And that's what I want to share with you now. And that is, there is a city. That longing that you have does have a true satisfaction or consolation that can be enjoyed. It won't be enjoyed fully in this life. That's why I had Pastor Mike read to you from Hebrews chapter 11, where we learn about a city whose builder and maker is God. And that's that city, by the way, that Christian is pursuing in the Pilgrim's Progress. The celestial city. That's where the longings that you have that can't be satisfied by the things of this world will be satisfied. You will find yourself, if you find yourself in that city someday, saying to yourself, at last, this is what I've longed for all along. Of course, what makes the city what it is the presence of God with his people. He will dwell with them, and they will dwell with him. We have those marvelous lines at the end of the book of Revelation, where we're promised that every tear will be wiped away and there will be no more sickness nor death. That's what we're looking for. We can't actually do it justice. We can more or less describe it in outline. And occasionally in literature, there are points where there's something that gives you a sense of what it must be like. I remember my oldest son, Caleb, told me that his conversion, the moment when in his life when he trusted Christ and believed the gospel, was when he came to the very end of the last battle in the Chronicles of Narnia. And in that book, we have a description of heaven. And I'd like to read it to you. This was the passage that Caleb points to when he talks about that moment where he had true faith. It may do it for you, maybe it won't, but I hope at least conveys to you a sense of what Christians are looking for and what that city is like. And it says, "And as he spoke," this is Aslan being referred to, "he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories. And we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before." That's our hope. Please pray with me.